Okay, I am back. So, I had introduced a new slide about resilience. I am not sure if there is previous recording stopped while I was talking. I have used my iPhone alarm to give me a signal when the hour finishes. Otherwise, I forget and I talk longer and longer beyond the recording. So I will repeat a bit. So resilience is a new and very hot topic. There's tremendous interest for resilience. The number of projects and publications on resilience has been growing exponentially for the last 20 years. And that is a transition from thinking about security in terms of vulnerabilities and risk, and you will then take measures to mitigate known risks, to include the fact that a lot of things happen that are unexpected. They occur because we don't have ability and knowledge to predict everything that could happen. There are a lot of definitions of resilience. Madoff, who is a consultant to the Congress in the US, did a survey of resilience, and he concluded, jokingly, of course, but with a grain of truth, there are as many definitions of resilience as people defining it. But even if you have a lot of different definitions, there is a core that is the same in all these definitions. It has to do that resilience is about the organizations, the systems, whatever, to be able to resist, to absorb, to recover from, or perhaps we should say, and to adapt to adverse changes in condition. A system that is able to move, recognize that the world is changing. So, resilience is extremely attractive because it's also a very positive attitude. Instead of thinking of the worst, what happened, how do I manage that, it is about developing strength in the system so that it is able to stay healthy. So, looking at the next slide. While resilience is very attractive, the problem is extremely complicated. The challenges are huge because still you have to characterize the vulnerabilities and ascertain, find out how resilient the system is. Then there are always limited resources, so you have to set priorities for how to mitigate and how much. Then you have to prepare for the unexpected, which is, of course, a huge area of unknown unknowns. And all at the same time, the systems that we are trying to protect very often are ill-defined, and they have multi-layered governance, especially if you think of big systems like critical infrastructure, cities to protect, or even the whole nation. Disasters of any kind can have a lot of sources. The systems can fail along many different ways, multiple pathways. The systems are interdependent in many ways, and when something happens, it can cascade through the system and create secondary and tertiary consequences that sometimes are worse than the original one. The systems have numerous collaborative patterns and networks, many of them you don't know well. And also, experience shows that, of course, disasters do not follow scripts. Because of that, when a disaster occurs, whether it is natural or man-made, whether it is a cyber attack or whatever, the system gets disrupted in a novel way that you never handled before. And that requires that there is a self-organization in the response, so as to adapt and deal with the confusing, disruptive situation that very often disrupts even the very same teams that are supposed to handle the situation. So here you see there are huge challenges, and indeed group model building is a key issue in our project Smart Mature Resilience. I think I gave you the link to that, where I am scientific coordinator. We are doing group model building with problem owners in different cities in Europe. We have met with representatives for critical infrastructure, but we have also dealt with other possible sectors, but it is most in critical infrastructure where you have issues related to information security. And we create models. In this case, we address the issue via a maturity model that we express in terms of a system dynamic model. This project is still ongoing. Tomorrow I will fly to Spain, and from Monday to Wednesday we will have a workshop with stakeholders, and we will review different solutions, including the emerging system dynamic model with the stakeholders in the city of San Sebastian in Spain, which is one of the 7 cities in the project. Another cities include the city of Kristiansand in Norway. Okay, and then finally, as last example, misaligned incentives. There is a very famous article that appeared in the world's most important scientific journal called Science by Ross Anderson, professor in Cambridge, and Tai Lamua, who at that time was at MIT, entitled The Economics of Information Security. And the article starts with this statement: over the past 6 years, people have realized that security failure is caused at least as often by bad incentives as by bad designs. And it concludes that the main reason for this is that systems are vulnerable and prone to failure when those who are responsible for guarding them, who can't ensure their security, are not those who suffer most if something happens. And this statement is now more true than ever. That means that, conversely to what many people believe, that security, information security, is a technological issue mainly, it is much more complicated than that. And we have to understand the psychology, the economics, the incentives in order to create good security solutions. And that leads to research questions also: how do misaligned incentives cause security failures? And how can we implement proper incentives for proper security? So now I have designed and drawn a landscape of issues where I have participated. And from that, I will then later show you models and research results, emerging results about that, so that you get a deeper understanding of security management and derived metrics and so on from these challenges. Now, integration of measurement history. I guess you have heard several times that a metric to be good needs to be accurate. So then my question is, should you avoid using inaccurate measurements? Well, reflect a little bit about that. In order to have an accurate measurement, you need quite an accurate and complete knowledge of the problem. But if you are dealing with a novel problem requiring research to elicit new knowledge and put it together so that it makes sense, then you don't have yet accurate measurements. If you look at the history concerning measurements, it shows that scientific and technological progress can be made starting with inaccurate measurements that become more and more accurate as you gain more and more understanding. And there is a moral that I can announce immediately: it's better to be approximately correct than exactly wrong. You are exactly wrong if you say, I don't want to use that metric because that's not accurate enough. I want to be accurate. Then you are exactly wrong. Let's look at the history of the measurement of temperature. So every one of us senses degrees of heat and cold, but that's not very accurate. And also that's subjective. What you feel is not necessarily what your partner feels, even if we have some degree of agreement. We can have different impressions. Some of us resist and you are heat better and therefore don't suffer from that or even from the cold. So the need occurred how to derive a precise objective measurement of heat and cold. That was a very old observation that you can trace back to 2,000 years ago. With Hero of Alexandria, at least, he demonstrated how a closed tube partially filled with air and its end in a container of water expanded the air when it becomes hotter and contracted, absorbed water when it became colder. That led to some devices called thermoscope that allowed to register changes in temperature. They didn't have a scale yet. It was a friend of Galileo Giovanni Francesco Sagredo, who lived in Venice. He was a noble man, but he was interested in science. He proposed adding a scale to Galileo's device so that it became a thermometer. Okay, that sounds nice, but let's look at the challenges. It took several centuries, about 2 to 3 centuries, until you had a good and reliable and accurate thermometer scale. There were several problems. The first key problem was how to establish the reference points of the scale. If you look at the thermometer, it has 2 points that have been determined according to some procedure. In the case of the Celsius scale, it is 0 and 100 degrees. But that was later. Now go back to the time of Galileo. They didn't know so well how to use, but they had the impression, you could call it a theory, that caves had the same temperature everywhere all the year round. Why caves? Well, that was air conditioning in Italy. The summers are very, very hot. So what did you do when the temperature outside was 40 degrees? Well, you went to the near cave, enter it, and you have a very nice air-conditioned situation. Perhaps a little bit cold, because caves, they don't have something like, say, 18 or 20 degrees, but perhaps they are down to 8 or 10 degrees. But still, that was better than suffering the hot. You can protect yourself with clothes and sit there in the cave. So people thought that all the caves were connected, and they had the same temperature. So the proposal was, take your new thermometer, go to the next cave, and wait until the recording stabilizes, and put a 0 on that scale. And then you needed another reference point for the scale, which was equally wrong. That had to do with the supposition that in the hottest day of the year, which I'll call the canine or dog's days in the middle of August, that the temperature was the same in all piazzas in Italy. So imagine how accurate that thermometer was if you calibrated that in different cities. So there was a lot of quarrel between the scientists because they were doing experiments and they are getting different results, and they quarreled, and the whole thing was resolved when they came together and they look at the readings and they recognize they all were right in the sense that they trust in the thermometers, but the thermometers were not correctly calibrated. So they were inaccurate, but they led to the discovery that you needed to improve the scale, the reference points. And after a while, even with the inaccurate thermometers, they could see that if you had freezing water that is water where you have liquid and ice in equilibrium. That stays stable for a long, long, long time. So if you are cooling the water until the whole water freezes, the recording in the scale of the thermometer and the thermometer stays at exactly the same point. So that was a big discovery that allowed them to have a stable point in the scale. They call it zero in the Celsius scale. Fahrenheit proposed a different method with salt water, which has a lower point and so on, but basically the same idea. And then they discovered that when water is boiling and it is fully boiled, the temperature stays constant, so that gave the two reference points. Still, that was a big progress, but that didn't solve all the problems. Because the first thermometers, they were open to atmospheric pressure. So when the atmospheric pressure changed, the reading changed as well. So they had to create thermometers where the liquid was in a vacuum, as it is today. So that improved that. And then they have still the problem that most substances that you use in the thermometers, they do not expand or contract linearly. So the changes, the scale, which is divided in equal distances, doesn't match the way the liquid really expands and contracts, because they don't follow exactly in a linear way. So it was when using these still inaccurate thermometers, the law of the gases was discovered that applies exactly when the gases are very diluted, when they are called ideal gases, that you finally had a thermometer with a good scale that wasn't influenced by air pressure, and that it had a linear scale. And that took 200 years. So these lessons can be expanded to any area. We start with incomplete knowledge. Our indicators may be not the best, and our metrics may be not fully accurate, but don't despair. Use that to make progress so that you can then improve your understanding and propose better indicators or better ways of measuring these indicators. So now let's start the actual description of group model building. We have three sources of data. We have data that are numerical, that is done by measurements. Then we have data that is text. It may also include numerical data, as you find in reports, publication, books, and so on. But then we do have data that is in people's head, in individual people's head. We call that tacit data because it normally has not been expressed, at least not in a way that is shared. And also, the important thing about this is that this data is individual. Now, if you want to make progress in some area, when you have a Nobel challenge, you have to use these three sources of data. And of that, very often the tacit data is the most important one, at least to open up the problem. But this tacit data is fragmented. Nobody has all the knowledge in the head. We have specialized knowledge. Modern society is not only about division of labor. It's also about the fact that modern society is able to utilize knowledge that is spread in many, many different heads. But when it concerns dealing with a challenge, we have to elicit this knowledge that is in different heads because people know different things, because they are experts in different areas, put it together to a model that allows us to see at the problem in a wholesome, in a holistic way. Another issue is that tacit data tends to be also inaccurate and incomplete. So both issues about how to elicit new knowledge that is fragmented, how to make it more complete by discovering holes in knowledge, and how to improve and make it more accurate, that is issues that we did with group model building. The issue, the way we do that, is that modelers and domain experts come together in workshops for jointly developing a model of the problem. Let me add the following. The fact that we do it jointly is not only about making sure that expert knowledge is elicited in use. The modelers are good at eliciting, facilitating, and once their knowledge is on the table, putting it together in a model. But they are not experts in the domain in questions. It is the people who own the problem, who know most about the problem, who have the expertise that needs to be elicited. So that's why we do it jointly. We have to do it jointly. But there is a second reason, a very, very subtle reason, why group model building is so effective. And that is, in contrast to the way when your organization, your company, engages an external consultant to look at your problem, they look at it and they come back and say, here's the solution. In contrast to that, in a group model building session, you are doing the modeling yourself, in that you are using the modelers to help you create the model. That means that the people, the domain experts who are involved in group model building, they have also a sense of owning the model. The model is their baby. Because the model is their baby, they will defend it, they will use it, they will talk about it, they will be pioneers, they will be champions for the model in the enterprise. That makes the model much more effective than if it comes externally from a consultant company that gets the problem issue and comes back after some analysis and say, here's our solution. So we, in a group model building session, the clue is to find experts in the enterprise organization who owns the problem, who best cover the different issues of the problem. Of course, this is not perfect because you will have to have the whole organization to cover all the knowledge. But if you have people who have deep understanding and represent different disciplines, they either have the knowledge or they know whom to ask in the company so as to get the necessary knowledge on board. And on the other side, you have the modelers. The modelers, they have the roles of facilitating the discussion at the workshop, record what is happening, putting the model pieces on the wall. We use sheets, plastic sheets, big plastic sheets that cover the wall where we can draw. We do it by hand. You have also some people working in the computers and projecting it, but it is better to do it by hand. All the time interacting with the audience, and in addition to facilitators, recorders who take notes and write minutes for the whole thing, and modelers who develop the model all the time jointly, we have a person who we call the process coach. This person just observes what is happening and assists the facilitator. For instance, by saying, okay, we are not involving everybody. There are some guys there who are not involved. Some people are shy and don't say so much, but they can have an important knowledge. Or I notice now you are spending too much time in this issue. People are getting bored or whatever. So the process coach is helping that the procedure runs well. And also that we are going group thinking, or that some authoritative person talks a lot and other people less. So we have to make it sure that everybody contributes with their expertise. And then finally, we tend to have what we call a gatekeeper. A gatekeeper is a representative of the problem owner, the organization, and it has the role to observe and make sure that the group model building really is addressing what it's supposed to be to do, also that it doesn't take off in the wrong direction, so that the organization or the company owning the problem really gets back what it's putting on the table in terms of resources and investment. So five important roles. The modelers will facilitate, record, and develop the emerging system dynamic models. They will elicit the fragmented knowledge. They will help resolve inconsistencies and contradictions. They will help also discover holes in knowledge that need to be filled and finding procedures to elicit or discover missing knowledge. Sometimes the way we discover missing knowledge is that we use the model, we simulate it, compare with actual data, and if it doesn't match, then we know something is missing. Then we find out what is missing by looking at the model that we have and what is causing the disagreement. So the model will be gradually built up. Depending on the complexity of the problem, a group model building could go on for several months, even for up to a year, or even longer if the problem is extremely complex. For instance, in our European project Smart Mature Resilience, we will be working 3 years together with our experts in order to develop complete models, validating, testing, use it in practice, and disseminate among the stakeholders. So here you see an overview of group model building. So we have an iterative procedure that will run over several workshops separated by weeks or months, with periods in the middle when the knowledge is consolidated. The facilitating and modeling team will develop group model building exercises for gathering data, for constructing the model, for making the fragmenting knowledge explicit, to build consensus in the group. If there is not consensus, there is some disagreement, then we need to resolve that. Why is there a disagreement? That means people come from different conclusions based on the expertise. We need to find out the reasons, and so as to achieve a model that is owned by everybody. When we have the model, we proceed from sketches that are gradually improved. The expert group knowledge, the model leads to insights that fits into the group model building process, and then the expert group will give more input. In over several workshops, it will proceed so that in the end we have a system dynamic model that we can use to analyze different course of actions, discover best practices, guidelines, or even proceed to standards. In fact, for instance, in our Smart Mature Resilience project, one of the partners is the German Standardization Agency, DIN, and they will propose standards that can be elevated to international standards later, standards on resilience, based on our findings. You are very quiet, so if if you have something, questions and so on, don't hesitate. Raise up your hand, come up with comments. Is everything clear? Okay, we continue. Everyone, okay, thanks Rune. So, as I said, group model sessions will be conducted in several workshops. Depending on the complexity of the problem, it could be something like 3 to 4 separated by several weeks, or in the European project that we have now, we have many more. I think we have in altogether about 12 workshops, again separated by several weeks. And we are rotating, so we have had workshops in all the cities so far, the 7 cities of the project. Now, the first workshop will simply start from scratch. The only thing we have is a detailed agenda that actually exists in 2 versions. One that is public for the domain experts. It tells the main things we are going to do in the order. And then another one, which is very detailed, technical, with internal notes for the modulars. Then in the next workshop, we still will have agendas. We call them scripts. Again, public and so on, and very detailed. But then we will proceed on the basis of the emerging simulation model that we have developed. So typically in the workshop we have a sketch of the model, then later the modelers will use the sketch to improve that. In between we will have chats with the experts to the extent necessary. We will involve them in interviews so as to validate the model, especially when we are simulating, so that they can see if that matches the data and so on and so on. The point with group model building workshops is avoid group thinking, making sure that everybody participate, making sure that we engage participants and that they appraise and evaluate emerging information. Conduct that in terms of indirect exercises to elicit, organize, visualize, and evaluate emerging insights, to express the insights in models, building consensus, and resolving disagreement. Here you see an example from a group model building exercise. Often the exercises occur in groups. We separate the participants in groups and ask them to deal with some exercise. I will come back to which kind of exercises they are. But let me say one thing. It is no use asking a question like, what is the problem that you have? You will be asking about a specification. But typically, the problems occur in terms of a lot of things that go wrong or don't go as you would like, or things that are confusing and so on. They are the symptoms of the problem. In order to have a real specification, exact specification that would immediately allow you to create a model, you have to understand all the symptoms and have put them together so as to give that. So it's a very, very different situation from, say, an examination paper. When I give you an examination paper, then I will describe a case, and then I will ask you to do some things. But here we have to build the case in the first place. And you cannot build the case by asking somebody in the domain experts, give me the specifications of the problem. This person will have a fragmented view of the problem, and it will address some symptoms, but not all, and will interpret the symptoms from his or her point of view, which is not a wholesome point of view for the organization. So we need to create the case and the specification by assembling all the fragmented information, make sure that it fits. And then, while we are doing this, we are making separate sketches, iterative sketches of the model that we are gradually improving over the different workshops. So, as typical examples of group work, we will ask the participants, who are the stakeholders for your problem? Who is interested in your problem? And how big is their interest? And how much can they influence the problem? I come back to that. Then you will ask us to indicators of the problem. Then we are coming close to metrics. How can you actually look at things that are connected to the problem over time? How can you measure them? And how do they behave over time? Because the models, they will be used to simulate the past history, and we will use the models then to project into the future. Well, not so much to make predictions, because the future will depend on decisions, and you don't know what is going to be decided. But we use that to explore the future. We can look at what if I do this, what happens? If I do that, what happens? To create a more deep understanding of the landscape, of the risk landscape, and so on, and about the impact of different decisions. Okay, and there are the other exercises. What is very important is that in order to avoid that some participant dominates the discussion, we ask everybody or every group to write in sheets like this, big sheets with big letters, proposals for stakeholders, for indicators and so on, and to prioritize them. Then we conduct the plenary, and in the plenary we ask first the group or individual, if we are dealing with individuals, please put on the wall your highest prioritized stakeholder, the one you think is most important. So it's put there. And we have then some stickers so that it is visible for everybody. Then we proceed to the next person in a round-robin manner. After everybody has presented their first choice for, say, stakeholders, then we take the second choice in a round-robin manner and so on until we have everybody. All the proposals are put on the wall. And then we engage in a plenary, everybody, to look at them and see, okay, probably some of you have proposed the same stakeholder, maybe with a different name. Let's now consolidate that. Then the people move that and put together until we have unique names and not longer duplicate names for the stakeholders. Similarly for the indicators and so on. So participants arrange the findings in plenaries. Now, let's look at a specific case. I will now discuss the group model building that we did in cooperation with Mnemonic. So it was during the 2005 to 2009 that I was co-supervisor for Finn Olav Sveen, who, by the way, for a while was here also employed in a part-time position at NTNU. I think he stopped 1 year or 2 years ago. He's now working for a company that was funded by a co-founder of PowerSim, a person that I work together with. Now, he has a company with a simulation tool called Dynaplan, and he is doing consultancy in the whole of Europe with big companies using simulation model. But there it's more about human resources where they are simulating. So Finn Olav was my master's student at the Agder University College before it became University of Agder. And he finished 2005. We became a university in 2007. And for a while, Finn Olav was with me with some temporary funding that I had. Among the things that I funded was his stay at SUNY Albany. SUNY Albany is one of the pioneers in system dynamics and group model building. So he was there for half a year. And he was very interested in a PhD, but I didn't have funding for a PhD at that time. So I asked my friends at the Faculty of Engineering, University of Navarra in Spain, with whom we have been collaborating since the year 2000, if they had a PhD financing. And they had it. They are not very well funded. They only get 1,000 euros per month, whereas here in Norway in a PhD funding you will get perhaps 2,500 euros. But 1,000 euros is good enough if you are a dedicated person and don't spend too much money for financing, you stay in Spain. So he was in the very beautiful city of San Sebastian next to France in the Basque Country for 4 years. And while he was there, using my contacts at Mnemonic, we conducted a project that was part of his PhD, Modeling Information Security Reporting System and Awareness with Mnemonic. So I will use some slides from his PhD thesis. His PhD thesis is among the literature that is supported to this course. You can use it if you want to learn more. You don't need it because my slides should be sufficient. So let's look at this, and if you want, you can inspect his PhD thesis for more details. Here you see typically a script. That's what I called before an agenda. It describes what we are going to do. in the session. You see the time, it is a public agenda, so that's where the participants see. We have a more detailed one. What we are doing, how we work in plenary, small groups, and so on, whatever, and so on and so on. This just as a brief illustration, don't bother about the details, just that you have an impression how we prepare for the work group model building workshop. Okay, that was too much, one slide back. So, as I told you, one of the exercises is asking the participant to propose stakeholders for the problem in question. Here about the incident response system at mnemonic. So, we people wrote in such A4 sheets with big letters, and then we produce electronic copy of that, and then we put on the wall the axis of interest and influence. After the consolidation exercise, where in the plenary we have reviewed the proposals for stakeholders and make sure that there were no duplicates and agreed on the names to use, then they were ranked according to interest and influence. So, for instance, visitors, mnemonic, they have not much interest and not much influence on the system. Strong interest are the users of the system, but they don't have as much influence. Users have the most influence on the system, but perhaps not as much interest as the security management, who has much stronger interest in the issue, but has not the same influence on the system, and so on. So the point with this exercise is that in this area here, in the upper right quadrant, that are the most important stakeholders for the problem, and they are those that primarily should be represented in the model. As to how many we include depends on how relevant they are. That's one of the decisions we have to do. Maybe we start with a conservative decision as to whom to include, maybe only this part. And then later, if it turns that this is good enough for describing the problem, then we stick to that. Otherwise, we add more stakeholders. By the way, a very important principle when developing simulation models is always to proceed from simple to complex. That is the famous Occam razor, not to introduce more items, more concepts than absolutely necessary. So we tend to start with very simple model with few elements, see if they are good enough to represent the problem. If not, then we ask the question, what do we have to introduce? We prioritize and take a new element and extend the model. The advantage of proceeding in this is that we have all the time models that grow from simple to complex, that we understand very well before we add new features, that we then understand before we add new features. In this way, we are all the time able to use the models for what is important, and that is for creating new knowledge and understanding. And also being able, if something strange happens, to be able to debrief and find the causes of the problem in the model. In another exercise, we ask about indicators, and then we ask the participators after a plenary where they have agreed on unique indicators as to how handy they are for the problem and how relevant they are for the problem, again, to allow us to select those that are more handy and most relevant in the first approximation in the model before we later perhaps add more if the model that we have created needs to be improved. Another issue, we ask about the behavior of the indicators. So say risk level at mnemonic, how was it? And then we ask about the historical behavior.